Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutting. Let's get into our first news story of today, and we're just going to be continuing on with a little bit of a discussion of the polling results that we had talked about on the show yesterday. And this is some analysis on a number of polls that have come out over the past couple of months from our former colleague, Gareth von Ornslin. Gareth wrote a piece for Politics Web in which he says there have been four substantive political polls since the 2024 election, two by the Social Research Foundation, one by the Brenthurst Foundation, and one by the South African Institute of Race Relations, which is, of course, us. And what he says, if I can kind of summarize his piece here, is that the ANC's base of support seems to be seriously cracking. By that, he means that on a good day, the ANC can push their numbers up to 43-45% of the vote, with lots of people kind of flocking to them to support them. This is particularly in times when the ANC seems to be running the GNU, at least in less crisis mode, when things seem to be going better. However, when things get bad, such as the middle of the budget dispute, their support level can drop down to 30%, which means that only their most hardcore supporters are still with them, and about around 25% of their potential voters are deserting them during times of trouble. This is a pretty bad situation for the ANC to be in, it seems, and it suggests that the party's kind of floor of support maybe shrinking. The DA has traditionally been a party that polls actually much higher before election periods, and then just towards the election kind of goes down as the ANC manages to bring people back. So it's possible that dynamic could still exist, but this really shows that the ANC is now, for the first time in its history, seeing a very significant chunk of its voters just kind of drifting, potentially wavering from the party. So the other comments he made were that MK and the EFF seem kind of maybe slightly down from where they were, but they're pretty much in a similar place to where they were in the 2024 election. The big fight now seems to be between the ANC and the DA. Chris, what's your takeaway from this?
Yeah, so I think a big thing here is, given, I mean, in the Institute's latest polling, given how low the ANC polled, but that neither the EFF nor MK saw any real pickup. I mean, again, the narrative is, those are just three. Those three parties are just the same block, and it's guaranteed that voters are going to go between them. I think that indicates that it's by no means guaranteed for parties like the EFF and MK that, should the biggest party in the country, or the supporters of the former biggest party in the country, should they become more and more disillusioned with the ANC, it's by no means guaranteed that they're just going to go to either MK or the EFF, that those parties don't also need to figure out, is their messaging fit for purpose? Is their leadership fit for purpose? Are they building the sort of necessary branch structures and doing all of that sort of work? So important for them in that regard to not just sort of, I guess, sit back and assume things will fall in their favor. But also, I think for the ANC, what lesson do they take from this? Do they realize that South African voters in general and ANC supporters more and more are focused on bread and butter issues, things that affect them materially, their quality of life? Or do they continue with the more ideological policy and legislative reforms and changes that they consistently promote? So things like expropriation without compensation, NHI, prescribed assets, et cetera, et cetera. For me, especially, it'll be interesting to see what lessons the EFF and MK take from this, and then the ANC. I do think it's also important always with polling to talk about it being a snapshot, sort of a photo of a given moment. So this was in the context of the budget dispute. The fact that for the first time we've had this sort of dispute, I think, is also a good thing, because it does show you that, at least amongst registered voters, if they respond like this in a poll, they are realizing that their democratic mechanism is still functioning. And what I mean by that is, for them, they realize their vote does carry an impact and an influence. So whoever they vote for, whether it's the ANC or whether they vote for parties, at least to bring the ANC below 50%, that continues to function well. So I know it's messy and it's noisy. I'm not saying it's easy to navigate, and that the markets especially dislike the sort of instability. But those are important points, I think. And just the last one, I think we might be too easily just glossing over the fact that the ANC is, that the vote share is becoming entrenched in the 30 to 40% range, Whereas before, to imagine the ANC below 50% would have been, I mean, blasphemy. You know, no, you shouldn't be allowed to say that sort of thing. And we shouldn't discount that maturation and development of South African politics in that regard.
Exactly right. All right, but a little bit more insight into what the ANC has, why they're having such difficulty actually changing, I think, their approach to things comes from our next story. And this is provincial task team coordinator that the ANC appointed in KwaZulu-Natal, Mike Mabuyakula, has talked a little bit about what he thinks is, he says that the risks to the government to provincial unity in KZN is not severe, that even if National has some problems, that they'll be able to hold together in KZN. But what was more interesting to me, rather than his comments on that, was his comments about the mistakes the ANC had made in the past. And I think this shows how difficult it is for the ANC to change their approach. Our colleague Terence Corrigan has often made the point that the ANC tends to view itself as a messianic organization, not just another political party. And I think you can see that in these comments. So let me read Mr. Mabuyakulu's comments here. He was talking to this meeting where there were civil society groups. And he said, the ANC must admit that it made mistakes in the recent past. He said, quote, as the ANC, we must accept we have experienced the sins of incumbency, and at times we may have made missteps. The ANC has been the trusted bearer of the people's aspirations for 113 years. From the tensions of the struggle through the dark days of apartheid to the dawn of democracy, the ANC has always been more than a political party. It has been a people's movement. He went on to say, however, in recent times, we must admit with humility and courage that we have experienced some missteps and may have committed tactical errors. If the mistakes were committed by other parties, nothing would have been made of them. But because the ANC is correctly held to a higher standard, these are cause for concern. We must accept and admit the mistakes. Chris, when this is your view of the world, it's very difficult to compromise on kind of anything. You know, he says here, this is a people's movement, regardless of whether majority of South Africans actually support the party or not. They are the authentic expression of the true will of the people in some way. When you have that kind of mindset and view of the world, sort of engaging with another political party as an equal is not so easy.
No, you're exactly right. When you've got these vibes-based words, sentiments, phenomena, you yourself can't be measured whether you've succeeded or failed. So more emotionless statements, more esoteric, more ideological, it can sometimes be a sort of cover for trying to avoid accountability, you holding yourself to account or someone else being able to hold you to account. Because if you are the people's party and represent the people's will, whatever you do by that fact, it's sort of a blank check. So that's where you seek your moral refuge and just your governance refuge when things don't go well. So I think it does help to, it goes some way towards, again, explaining why the ANC sometimes does what it does, where it falls back to some of these positions. It doesn't go far enough because a lot of the time it's also just purely extractive and for sort of extractive networks that they build these cater deployment networks and implement the policies that they do to protect their own interests. But there is that fallback of a sort of moral justification, because if you represent the people of South Africa, what could you be doing? It is circular reasoning, right? So by virtue of being the People's Party and the People's Liberation Party, whatever you do is in their interest and represents their interest. So it can't ever, your reasoning can't ever be defeated in that way. So it does make sense, I think, to see this every now and then. It is illustrative of where many in the party, unfortunately, remain, despite the reality of which they've driven South Africa into sort of economic decline. If you wanted to be serious about what this opportunity afforded that the ANC dropped to 40% in last year's elections, I think then you would need to look at, okay, how are we going to move from this going forward, and what is practical in terms of holding each other to account? So for the first time, saying it's not just about renewal, it's not just about reinvigorating, it's not about liberation movement, but it is about if in 3 months' time there are still ministers, ANC ministers in cabinet who are credibly linked to corruption, what do we do about that? So make take this seriously, if you really, quote unquote, want to represent the people of South Africa, there are opportunities for the party. But I think the decline is guaranteed at this point. So maybe I'm wishing for too much in that regard.
I think it's also kind of interesting on the sort of Masonic point about that view of history. He says that the ANC has been the people's movement for 113 years. Now, I think there were various points in South Africa's history where the IFP, the PAC, the Black Consciousness Movement, all these other groups could have made a similar claim and had perhaps much more evidence to support it. And yet he sort of believes that from the day that, you know, a relatively small group of people got together to found this party, that it inherited this great mission of history and this sort of legitimacy even long before it actually faced the voters. Anyway, something interesting to think about. Okay, for our last story, we're just going to briefly talk about some plans and schemes and great promises made by the health minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, who says that he is planning on spending another 1.3 billion rand to improve healthcare infrastructure in the country. He says that they are going to be refurbishing three of South Africa's academic hospitals and will be building another three. And this would bring the number of academic hospitals in the country to 16, up from 10. Apparently, three of them are in existence right now, but are basically considered temporary. Motsoaledi said, if our healthcare system is weak under the national health insurance, it will make it more expensive because people will move to very expensive private hospitals. Our own hospitals, especially academic hospitals, are able to do the same job. It's also to make NHI very affordable and hospitable for our people. He said that while the details of this proposal to spend all this money on health infrastructure was being finalized, it is likely to draw on the budget facility for infrastructure and the infrastructure fund to complement existing budgets for health infrastructure. So that's where he says that the money will come from. Chris, I don't think we have time to unpack some of the errors with this. But one of the ones that continues to irritate me is the kind of assumption that we'll just spend a bunch more money and the healthcare system, the government healthcare system, will just work better. Yes, funding is a problem in the government healthcare system, but the biggest problem is mismanagement of the money that's already there.
So if I wanted to steel man, I guess, my ideological opponent in this debate, I could say that building new facilities will take some pressure off existing ones, assuming that the new ones are fit for purpose, that a lot of the resources aren't wasted, etc., etc. Delivered on time. I mean, the very basics, right, of sort of project management 101. But that is not the reality that South Africa sits with. So, I mean, even something like the NHI, which the Institute, for example, has tried to estimate the cost of, I mean, it could be 200 billion rand a year, it could be up to 500 billion rand a year, assuming you've got a trillion rand a year to spend on the NHI. What in that fixes the current governance, management, procurement, training blockages in policy and legislation which the government has imposed over the last 30 years that drives public healthcare quality into the ground, that drives workers, public healthcare workers, doctors and nurses and specialists to the private sector or overseas? What about the training of doctors and nurses, which every year, unfortunately, gets brought up because that legislation that is in place ensures that people aren't allocated to where they should be, that ensures that pipeline isn't as strong as it should be. So I think you're exactly right to highlight that no matter how much money you have in South Africa's healthcare sector, public and private, if the legislation and policies don't change, then there's no reason to think that the outcomes are going to improve. Ordinarily, one would want to admire the sort of stretch goal and this vision of building new facilities. You've got a growing population. You need to cater for that if you want to be the sort of capable state. But I think you would find much more support for your plans, much more buy-in from the private sector and from South Africans generally across racial lines, across income strata, if you showed you're serious about getting your current public facilities up to some kind of scratch, not even going from sort of, if we're talking about credit ratings, not going from junk status to just above junk status, but going from junk status to adequate, to sort of median levels, and then we go up from there. That requires, of course, hard work, which is partly why there's always a talk about, oh, we just need more money, because there doesn't want to be a focus on the difficult day-to-day work from national right. to provincial departments to address some of these issues.
No, and you cannot discuss spending, I think, on our public healthcare system without acknowledging the shockingly high levels of corruption that we've been seeing all over the place, that people like the whistleblower Bobita Diokran were murdered over, trying to expose. Those problems have not been dealt with. And until those problems are dealt with, I do not think the healthcare system, the government healthcare system, has proved that it can be trusted with the tax money of South Africans. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for watching. We hope you found the show interesting. That's a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.